I'm Randy Brandt. I'm a local guy. I was born here in Spokane, went to Stevens Grade School, Lewis and Clark High School, Gonzaga University, and Gonzaga Law School. For a period of time, I was in the funeral business, and because of that, I became a deputy coroner for many years, and from that, I received the Outstanding Public Servant Award when I was a deputy. And then I was in construction for a while I was in law school, and real estate, of course, and construction. And my last project was called Rossmore Ridge up on 5 Mile. I became an attorney in 1988, started pro tem judging, which is an attorney that's on call to hear cases, in 1993. So that started my quest for becoming a judge.
How did you get from the construction business to wanting to be a lawyer?
I had wanted to be a lawyer for years, and I just thought it was an insurmountable quest. I've used that word twice now, but I just thought it was a goal that was too lofty. And then I started doing some research, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go take the LSAT, the Law School Aptitude Test, and I did well on it. And it kind of kicked me towards, maybe I better look at this more intensely. So I started at the night program at the law school while they still had it.
Gonzaga.
At Gonzaga, yes, sir. And I'd work during the day, and then I'd school at night, and then school at the weekends, and then I accelerated so that I could, through summer, and so I could graduate sooner. I passed the bar the first time I took it. So I started law school on my birthday in 1985, and then graduated in 88 and took that bar and was admitted in November of 1988. So there's a 5-year limitation to when you can start being a pro tem. So, I mean, within 2-3 days of my 5th anniversary as an attorney, I was allowed to pro tem on a docket, and I had my dear mother there. She got to see her son on the bench, and that was very important to me. So from 1993 to 2003, that's a 10-year period, I served as a judge pro tem.
What is a pro tem judge?
Well, a pro tem is an attorney that's called in to do either specialized dockets or just general dockets. If a judge is on vacation and they know that you can do the job on the bench, that judge and sometimes when you get a little more experience, the operations manager can just call you in and say, I have a docket, I've got a motion docket, or I've got I've got an arraignment docket, or I've got a pretrial docket, any of the documents. So by the time I'd been doing it for 10 years, there wasn't a docket that I didn't get put to or set on. Because of my extensive civil background, being in real estate and being out in a small business owner, I own 2 real estate companies. So I did a lot of small claims cases, which I think are wonderful. They're like, you know, the people's court, literally, I think. So I enjoyed that a lot. But it's pro tem, pro tempore. It's a temporary. So you may, you know, I could get a call one day and not be called again for 2 or 3 days. But it's a real fill-in for judges. So after 10 years of doing that, I was appointed as a court commissioner. And that is an actual county employee. You're not outside the system on an on-call basis. I was there on a daily basis. I started as a half-time commissioner and then went to three-quarter time. So I did that for 10 years, from 1993 to 2003. And then at that time, there were 5 court commissioners. Due to budget constraints, all of us lost our jobs. It was a RIF, reduction in force. So I applied for and got a job as a judge for the state. Now that's called an administrative law judge, and that's an internal within the system, and I heard appeals to unemployment cases. And that gave me a lot of great appellate background. That was very helpful. That was in 2009, 1993, 2003, 2003 to 2009 as a commissioner. And then I went to work for the state Office of Administrative Hearings, great job, great people. But then I got an opportunity to apply to be appointed as a judge. I applied, and I was unanimously approved by the three Spokane County Commissioners. And I became a judge. And then I ran in 2012 to keep my seat. And then I had to run again in 2014. And as you know from the records, I did not win at that election. So I've been doing some pro bono work, just helping people out, you know, for free and in the interim and doing some part-time work. And so.
So you talked about as soon as you could, 5 years, that you decided you wanted to be a judge. Why did you want to be a judge rather than an attorney?
It's probably an overused phrase, but it was literally my calling. It's a love for the work that I did and do, I guess, and it's just a passion. I love the fast pace of the district court. You know, most of our trials would last 1, 2, maybe 3 days on a rare case, but usually you could hear a case in the morning and a case in the afternoon, as opposed to the judges on the Superior Court, where, as the news shows, that you can have 2, 3, 6 week trials. I just have never had an interest in that. I don't ever. I just prefer the fast pace. So I literally, before I went to law school, I knew in my mind that I was going to become a judge. That was my goal, to go to law school. Practice is necessary for the experience, and I got a lot of good trial experience. And in that time, I did about 25,000 real estate closings, and that flows out of my real estate background. So it just seemed a natural course for me. So being a pro tem, you don't, in those days, I think it was $50 per day or per docket, not per day. And when a person could make 3, 4, 5 times that practicing law in those days. So it was something I knew I had to commit to reach my ultimate goal of becoming a judge.
Okay, so do you have a particular favorite kind of, you talked about liking small claims court. Are there particular types of cases that you like to try rather than others?
Doug, I had the mental health docket, a therapeutic docket, for quite a while. And it's probably the single most rewarding docket that I, or what I think any other judge, could hear. It's an alternative to incarceration, and it's a way of performing a service that we called wrapping with services. So, for example, if someone lived in the valley and had a lot of failure to appears, which resulted in a warrant, which could result in their arrest and incarceration and then being brought before a judge to determine if they should be released or set a bond, we have this program where, well, if they lived in the valley, back to that example, we would make sure they got a bus pass. If they needed health care, we would hook them up with Chaz Clinic. If they needed housing, we had avenues to help them with housing. So rather than having people that have challenges of many different natures, we would become a guiding force in their life and give them structure. And we had where they would work to stay in compliance, because if you wrap someone with these services and they see that there's another way of life, and that they can always come back to our court, whether we had resolved their case or not, they were always welcome, and many did. They'd come in and say, "Hi, Judge, just want to let you know I'm doing well, and I'm getting married next week, or I have a job, and here's what I'm doing." We tried to fill in the blanks of their life so that they had a chance to survive and thrive.
So you had mentioned the People's Court just a little while ago.
Yeah.
So that's how a lot of people, that's kind of their window into the legal system. How close is it to real life?
It's not Judge Judy. I always had a dispute with my mother, who loved the Judge Judy show. I think that's too, what's the fancy word, vitriolic. It's too venomous. It's too nasty. But that's for ratings. I've always felt that a judge, well, let me just talk about myself. I have always tried to demystify that court proceeding. where they're explaining terms rather than saying, you know, sir, you've been you've FTA'd three times on an NCO, and so this is a probation violation hearing. What do you have to say? You know, through a counsel, of course, and you know, no contact. NCO is a no contact order. FTA is failure to appear. Probation violation hearing is that there's an allegation that they've done something that violated their probation. They're brought back to court. And then that little snippet that I just gave you, that is where many of the people that were allowed to enter the mental health docket, that's where they were falling down time after time after time. And one of the elements that a judge looks at to determine, is this person, should I favor a release on their own recognizance? If they have, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 failures to appear on time in court, well, it's kind of an indicator that they're just not showing up. But then with the mental health docket, we could look at why they weren't showing up. Was it, well, we had one fella who was embarrassed that he was hard of hearing. And so he knew American Sign Language. So we always, as soon as he came in, we picked that up. So we had an American Sign Language interpreter always available for his hearing. And so it was, there's a lot that goes into that. But I was a presiding judge. I was acting presiding for a couple of years and then became presiding judge in 14. So I sat on every docket that we had, you know, and I loved it all. There wasn't a docket that I did that was displeasurable to me. I mean, I'd love to go in and sit down, and I always tried to lighten the docket a little bit with just a very small touch of a humor. Because people come to court and they're fearful. They're afraid of what's going to happen. So I would start with a little opening comments about, you know, I want you to relax. There's no reason to be frightened here. Your case will be heard. You're going to have an opportunity for an attorney. I always, on every criminal docket, would advise people of their rights. And luckily, I've been able to travel around the world to many countries with my late father. He was a corporate pilot or commercial pilot. So I've been in countries where I knew that and I was an attorney at the time, if I had to argue a case in court, you know, I could be at a huge disadvantage, just language. So there are several cues to different cultures, you know, and so as soon as we would pick up on that, or if they would utter a word, we had a large poster in the back of the courtroom that was in all the primary languages, your right to an attorney and your right to these services. And when I left the bench, I was working on a handout that was similar, and it would have in all the primary languages, you know, if you need an attorney, you can check here. But even if they didn't understand that, I would always appoint an attorney for them. They always had to have access to justice accordingly or appropriately. And my bailiff would many times escort them over to the public defender's office, at least for an initial screening and a workup, and have an interpreter available. So access to justice is very important in our society. I think it's how our entire system, it's the basis. Everyone has their day in court, so to speak.
So how do you think people should evaluate judges when they go to the polls? I mean, what's the reason why people should choose one person over another?
To me, it's clear. Experience. Now, I have two prosecuting attorneys that are running for the same position. One's a county prosecutor, one's a city prosecutor. But I think experience makes a difference. And here's my analogy, Doug. If you're going in for major heart surgery, someone's going to crack your chest and work on a valve. Do you want someone that's been doing it for 21 years, who's had 75,000 surgeries, or do you want someone who stood by and observed? I think the decision is pretty simple when you think about how important experience is in certain professions. Being an attorney and being an advocate for one side or the other gives one experience in the courtroom protocol, I'll call it, or the environment. But there is no substitute for having to hear attorney A and attorney B and making a decision that affects people's lives. And so it's just purely experience. You know, I started in 1993 and for the most part continued uninterrupted until 2014. Someone who has done everything from major felony arraignments, to which I set rather high bonds, all the way down to parking tickets. Loved them all. And one of the other things, Doug, I don't know if this is in direct response. One of the things on this access to justice and this speedy resolution, the system generated or created this early case resolution docket, which is great. And on my arraignment docket, we would resolve. We would go from start to finish and conclude the case on 80% of the cases that came through the door. The remaining 100 cases came in the morning, and we would resolve 80 of them. And how that's done is that the judge has to leave the bench. So I'd go back into chambers, and then the public defender would meet with the prosecutor, meet with his client or her client, and work up a resolution. If it was acceptable, they'd send it back in a resolution in an order, and I would sign it, and those people could do very commonly community service, pay some minimal fines if there was damage to property or something like that. And those other 20% were set for trial. And that's just a preliminary. I mean, it could ultimately be the date of the trial, but it's usually just a staging. They'd set them for a pre-trial docket. And I should probably amend that they would be set on a pre-trial docket. And there'd be more opportunities for resolution, more discovery, more document gathering, more information, more witness interviews, and so that the prosecutors and the public defense or private defense would be in a position that they could make a resolution offer. So many of those were resolved. Now, those aren't the higher-end crimes. The district court, when I say the people's court, because I think it's a great term, we are the court that almost anybody who ultimately ends up in court for whatever reason, from a felony to a parking ticket, their case is going to be heard. The vast majority are at the district court level. They're speeding tickets. They're an assault. They're a DUI. They're a domestic violence, which are serious. They do really need addressing. So it's what the general populace is going to come to court for. And so therein is that term that I think is well used, people's court. Superior Court, thank goodness, has the higher end cases. They have the major crimes and the family law issues and separating someone from their children or their spouse, landlord-tenant issues as it relates to evictions. But I heard hundreds of cases where people have damaged real estate. So my 15 years as a real estate broker and a property owner and a renter, a landlord, I knew those, the proverbial back of my hand. So I was put on a lot of those dockets, and they would actually schedule 4 or 5 landlord, tenant, damage to property type cases before me. So I had a construction company, so I know about structures. I know, you know, the typical things that renters can damage: flooring, subflooring, windows, doors, appliances, the sheetrock walls, all that. So to me, it was kind of old homework to hear a small claims and landlord tenant. But I heard engine repairs, also cases involving animal breeding. But if it has a criminality element to it, that's either in the primary district court or it could be in the superior court, depending upon the financial level of it.
Sure. So those are my questions for you. Were there anything that I didn't raise that you wanted to talk about?
I'm just an all-around nice guy.
You seem to be one, yeah. Yes.
Well, Doug, it's real simple. I've been involved in the community, not only being on the bench. I've really worked to the proverbial give back. It's somewhat artful to say that, but, you know, very early on, I got involved at the Exchange Club. And then I was on the board of the Spokane River Association, which involved environmental and developmental wildlife issues in the Spokane River from Lake Coeur d'Alene to the border. And so that was very instrumental in kind of being the watchtower, the guard of what's going on the river, because it's exploding over there, you know, the development. And so then I went from there. I've gone to I'm stammering here. 3 judicial colleges. When I became a commissioner, when I became a judge, and then when I became a judge again. And so that's huge. That's a wonderful program. And I was granted a scholarship to the National Judicial College to get training in domestic violence issues. And that was a week long, probably the most intense training I've ever received, including college. It was very difficult but very rewarding. So I'm currently in the Spokane Central Lions Club, and I'm president of the Spokane Regional Law Enforcement Museum. Mm-hmm. So that's been a wonderful opportunity just to be with the people that are protect our community and those that have retired. And so we meet and we once a month, and we maintain the artifacts from the law enforcement and first responders here in the area. So if you know of any good commercial locations that we can put our museum, we lost our lease downtown. So we're maintaining all the artifacts, the vehicles, and the documents that go to support our law enforcement museum. So
where was the previous site?
It was down on 2nd Avenue. Yeah, remember where the old password paging service?
Yeah,
it's okay. Right in that vicinity.
Okay.
So. But it's tough on museums in this world, in this economy right now, the small ones. You know, we don't have big funders. But so being involved, and also one of my very enjoyable community efforts is that I'm an honorary commander of the United States Air Force Base Fairchild. And so I'm a community liaison for the base. You may be one also.
Mm.
I don't know. I think I've been doing that for 15 years. I am the judge, with quotes, on the DUI mock crash for area high schools. And we try to do at least one. Maybe I should back up. We always do one and try to do two before prom in the high schools. And it's a theatrical reenactment. And there's a gentleman named Paul Fuchs who is a giant in this. Sadly, his sister was the victim of a DUI crash, so he's got a real passion for this, and it's where we set up with the high schools, and we get crashed cars and they hide them from the students, block the vision with buses and such, and then they reenact a fatal DUI crash, and the drama students or the And some of the business, the DECA people, they get involved and they're all made up. They have pieces of glass protruding and all kinds of things. So they see what happens. The students see when it's all revealed what happens at a crash site. For example, we've had some in the rural areas, and the state patrol responds, the county sheriff, city police, EMS, fire trucks. And then when we are in a rural, they come in with a helicopter and evacuate the survivors. And then there's a hearse. And so the people that are the fatalities are loaded into the hearse. Then the students are taken into their assembly area, a convocation hall or a gym, and we have a funeral. And we have a casket present and a cremation urn. And so we have a funeral. Hand out memorial folders just like you'd get at a funeral. And then we have a sentencing. So there's kind of a jump in time, but then the judge comes in, and that's played by me, and we have a trial just for a hearing just for the purpose of sentencing. And I'll tell you, it is very emotionally charged. And the people that you wouldn't expect to be as emotional are the ones that are sobbing. And these the young people that play the defendant, a female or male, the last one we did was at Lewis and Clark. And he said, "I couldn't turn around and even look at my parents. I was so impacted by this, and I realized I'm not going to drink." And Doug, our philosophy has been, through Paul Fuchs, is that if we save one life, it's all worth it, and then some. But we get a lot of feedback. You know, a lot of the parents come up, and I mean, they literally will line up to thank all of us that play the parts, and the first responders. And so that's a palpable, direct way that I know that I'm giving back and helping those who are our next upcoming generation. So, but back to your original questions, it's just experience. Going to have surgery? Do you want an experienced guy doing it or a woman? Or do you want someone that's just watched? Never put their hands in it. They've just watched. Now, that watching is a valuable lesson or experience, but there is no substitute for experience. And another, because of my dad's commercial pilot, I've used an example. If you're on a transatlantic flight, you're on your way to England, and past the point of no return, and you have two of four engines go out. Now you've got another engine go out, so you're single engine from halfway. Do you want a guy that's been sitting, or pilot, a guy or a guy, a female, you want him sitting in the left seat that's got 21 years experience, or someone who's never even been in the cockpit?